Chapter 59. The question is why the White King changed his strategy so drastically. All these months of raiding and we haven't answered that damned basic question, Kip said. Weeks after the attempted assassination in the woods, the Mighty were seated around yet another fire at yet another camp, having yet another talk. It was not the first, nor indeed the 15th time Kip had asked the question aloud. I know we need to talk about the battle tomorrow, but this first, he said. He had grown more comfortable with giving commands, even ones nobody liked. And they'd grown more comfortable accepting them, too. Not even Winston complained that it was late and they probably weren't going to solve what he saw as a non-problem. They knew he'd get to the battle plan and that they'd need to be sharp when he did, in case he had in-depth questions about their positions.
Why does there have to be a grand answer? Cruxer asked. The White King felt he was getting overextended, so he paused. The break does him more good than it does us. He has secured and fortified his supply lines between Attash and the siege at Greenhaven. Not even we could get to those unless we wanted to give up Dunvio and the lake.
Dunvio. The non-floating, floating city was the forester name of the city the Nightbringers were going to try to save tomorrow. It controlled access to the great river and the immense lake by which Greenhaven was getting what little supplies it still was.
He's also had to deal with us, Ben-Hadad pointed out.
Isn't it possible that we actually stopped him?
But he was advancing steadily, Big Leo said, just as he has everywhere. Why stop halfway through Blood Forest? Why not at least push to the Great River everywhere and then consolidate?
Too much guerrilla warfare that way? Winston suggested.
He could capture the cities, but if he doesn't deal with us first, supply lines get long and vulnerable.
That could be it. But he'd advanced so fast elsewhere, leaving small forces to mop up any continuing resistance. Was Blood Forest simply different because of its huge population of hunters and hard terrain for supply lines?
All the fights we've had have kept us from linking up with the satrap's forces, Tysis said. If he pushed us to the river, it's the only place we'd have to go.
We don't want to link up with the satrap's forces, Kip said.
Satrap Bruin Willowbough wanted Kip's army. And Kip, if he could get him. What he didn't want was another person running around his satrapy with an army he didn't control. Which was understandable, and the man was a decent sort. Unfortunately, he was also a moron who had no idea what to do with the army he already had. There was no way Kip was going to take orders from him about how to use his own very peculiar forces.
We all know that, Tysis said, but the White King doesn't. Joining forces is what most defenders would do.
You think he's allowed us our victories? Kip asked.
Not the first one at Dora Neve, Tysis said. Maybe not the skirmishes around the Ironflower Marsh or the Deep Forest Ambush. But we've sometimes travelled pretty far to get disappointing quantities of food or muskets, and you yourself said the black powder wagons were an assassination attempt.
It had been a hollower victory than Kip had hoped. They had done everything right, wiping out the enemy and seizing everything with minimal losses. They even successfully disarmed the booby-trapped wagon. But then they found that of the five wagons, it was the only one loaded with powder. The other barrels were loaded with a layer of black powder, then sawdust. The men of the wagon train hadn't even known they were bait. It was small comfort that the war dogs had hunted down the scouts sent to watch the outcome. It was small comfort that Kip had been right, and there had been two scouts.
We haven't fought many drafters either, Kip said. We're missing something here.
Maybe we are, Cruxer said. But then the question is whether the White King has some grand design or whether it's just an error. He's already spent many lives to keep us away from a place we never intended to go. Just at the wagons he lost several hundred men, half a dozen whites and five wagons, trying to kill you. He's a good orator, an inspiring leader by all accounts. But maybe he's simply a poor strategist.
Poor enough to take two satrapies, Winston said dryly. If anything, Kip thought, he himself was the one who was a poor strategist. Good tactician, loved by his people, but he still couldn't resolve the big picture.
Damn how he'd love to take some lectures with Corvin Danavis now. When he was a boy, he'd wanted stories of battlefield heroics. Given the chance now, he'd say, "Talk to me about rations for cavalry when moving through forested river valleys. What's the breakdown of your command staff per soldier?"
That was when the Chromeria didn't know what we were up against, Cruxer said.
Cruxer still said we when he talked about the Chromeria.
Kip loved him for that idealism, but he didn't share it any more.
"He's successfully stalled reinforcements, though," Tysis said. "We know from the White's letters that he's been trying to turn the other satrapies to his side, or at least keep them out of the war. That's not the work of a poor strategist."
That Carys had written to the Nightbringers at all was the biggest shock for Kip. Without shaming anyone, she'd laid out the numbers. Tyria and Atash were lost. The Elysians didn't care who won. The Nukaba's Paria had pulled back all its soldiers after Oxford and had never sent reinforcements, and other than the several hundred men Irene Malagos had sent under Antonius and her continuing supplies, Hrothgar had pulled back to its side of the Great River, busily fortifying a border too long and too porous to be fortified well. Kip might have been at fault for part of that. Irene could be forgiven for not wanting to send more soldiers when Kip simply took them. And if Kip's co-opting of Antonius and his men was the reason Hrothgar wasn't sending reinforcements to Greenhaven, Kip could well become the reason the Chromeria lost this war. With all those satrapies out, only Arbornia and the small army directly under the Chromeria's control were left. Carys had said nothing about that, and Kip wondered if that meant they were coming, but coming late. Or coming as part of a stratagem to sweep in at the last moment. Or if Andros Gyle had decided to cut his losses and let Blood Forest die. Carys had also written about her insight that the White King wouldn't mind a slaughter of both sides, and in fact might prefer it so he could remake the entire culture of the Seven Satrapies. It had seemed an odd, paranoid thought at first, but Kip didn't think so any more. The White King hadn't sent one man or one squad on a suicide mission. He'd sent hundreds to die, just to kill Kip and Tallak. And from how the camp had fallen, except for a couple of the Whites, those people hadn't volunteered. That was some cold-hearted butchery there. "So he's successfully tying up our reinforcements from coming," Kip said. "But he's not pressing his advantage. Why? Why? Ben-Hadad chimed in for the first time. "I don't mean to distract us from this highly profitable colloquy that is still not answering a question we haven't been able to answer for many months, but maybe we should talk about the battle that's going to shape our entire future that we are going to fight tomorrow." Big Leo looked down at him.
"You take that crazy talk and get out of here."
"What's a colloquy?" Farkudi asked.
No one answered him. Kip acquiesced, even though he felt he was close to figuring it out. Another almost. Kip, almost.
"Enough," Kip said. "Let's go inside."
They moved to the map in the command tent. By this point, Kip had trained others in how to create the things, which was fortunate given that they needed new maps constantly as they moved.
"Let me lay this out plainly," Kip said. "Tomorrow's battle at Dunvio will either be the crowning achievement of all our work to keep our strength secret, or it will be the end of our hopes to save Blood Forest."
There were grim faces all around and a few muttered curses. Handsome General Antonius Malagos cursed quietly. He was perhaps the only one who hadn't guessed. "It's for this that I've tried so hard to paint us as raiders by force, allocation, and by strategic disposition. Tomorrow we fight our first pitched battle. They shouldn't expect us to be prepared for this kind of fight. I'll be blunt, we might not be. Before now, retreat has always been part of our plans. If things went poorly in a raid, we ran. I hope we haven't ingrained that into our troops."
"We won't run, my lord," Antonius said.
It was his supreme confidence in Kip that made him a useful battlefield commander. It spread to his men. Kip could only hope it spread enough.
"Here are the stakes," Kip said. "Hiding behind its green wall, Dunvio has always been a defensive redoubt. They never projected force into the forests beyond them. But perched as they are at the mouth of the river, they've kept the river open to the lake. Besieged, it's been nothing to the war. Freed, it can become a gateway to a huge number of supplies. Lost, it becomes a stranglehold."
"We free it, we can save Greenhaven," Cruxa said. "We lose it, we lose Greenhaven."
"Right," Kip said. "And we don't know how bad things are inside the city, except to know they're bad. They've been able to bring in some supplies from the river, but the capitals mostly needed those supplies for themselves. We can't expect any help from the city. The Council of Divines is made up of old cowards. At best, if we're already winning decisively, they might send some small force to help."
"I doubt it."
"That's just fantastic," Winston grumbled.
No one upbraided him.
"But if we win," Kip said, "if we win with the skimmers, we can land anywhere on the lake. We'll own the lake.
With resupply readily available to us and to Greenhaven, and with our forces able to strike anywhere we choose, lifting the siege of Greenhaven will be only a matter of time.
Save the city, save the satrapy, Cruxa said.
Cruxa was right, and Kip was maybe telling too much, but he always wanted his inner circle to know the full strategy. If he was killed, someone else would need to take the torch. A lot of lives depended on it. Not that he said the last part aloud. That would only devolve into protestations that he couldn't die. Dunvio was a strange city. It had once been the religious centre of one of the Nine Kingdoms. Dunvio had been deliberately shunned since the establishment of the Seven Satrapies, but never destroyed. Apparently it was a beautiful place, and Lucidonius had believed that every beautiful thing man creates points to how the creative spirit of Orholm himself lives in all people. So instead of being destroyed, the city had been starved of influence. No one born in the city or who had spent more than 10 years there total could hold any position of power in Blood Forest, the Cremeria, or the Magisterium. Thus, as soon as any family native to the city rose high enough to entertain ambitions of being greater, it left. It bore and raised its children elsewhere, and those children generally didn't want to come back, lest they spend more than their decade there. It meant, oddly, that there were a lot of nobles dispersed throughout Blood Forest and Hrothgar who had ties to the place, because the smart, the ambitious, and the strong were exported instead of killing each other off. The Malagos family had first risen from Dunvio, which was one reason Tysis had so many ties to Blood Forest, while her family was technically Hrothgari.
Commander, over to you, Kip said.
Cruxa pointed to a map of the city as it had been before the siege. It showed the city surrounded on three sides by trees, and also filled with trees, more than any other city in the world. He gestured, and a swath of trees around the city walls disappeared. The maps were put together now by a team of drafters and Doan Aleph of the Cuni War, who was in charge of the scouts, and Tysis, who interviewed the refugees. The maps now allowed them to advance time and see the reports appear as they had come in. 2 months ago, the Bloodrobes cleared the forests around the city for 100 paces in every direction. They believed that the city was being resupplied through the trees, Derwin said.
Which is nonsense. There were ladders and rope swings concealed in those trees so that single scouts and messengers might move through the Sylvan Giants quietly. But entire convoys of food? Impossible.
Any caves? Conarthur asked.
Few and none deep, Derwin said. Not only do you have the tree roots to stop that, but there's the groundwater to deal with. The river runs partly through the city itself.
It is possible there could be caves, Ben-Hadad said, purely from an engineering perspective.
But I guess it depends what you mean. Do you mean, do the inhabitants of the city have any tunnels, or are you asking about sappers?
Either, both, Kip said.
The city might have made tunnels. If you took your time, and I mean years, you can dig and pump out the water and seal the tunnels with Luxin and support them appropriately, Ben-Hadad said. I mean, you'd be constantly fighting the roots and leaks in the wood and Luxin, but it's possible. The city has been here a long, long time, but to do it and then maintain it would require a permanent corps of drafters.
Drafters of average ability? I'd say you'd need 30 or 40, which is expensive and very hard to keep secret.
You can hide what 1 or 5 drafters do, but when you have 40, people wonder, people gossip, and spies find out.
Farkuri said, Dunvio doesn't have 40 drafters. 38 tops in the whole city, and surely most of those would be tasked with defence, right?
As far as Kip knew, Farkuri didn't have any ties to Dunvio, nor did he see the scouts' reports.
Why do you say that? Cruxa asked, before Kip could.
Oh, Farkuri said, finger lodged up his nose, you just cross-reference all the activation lists of the lords in the surrounding areas with lists of the freeing. The Cuni War and the ghosts. Take out those we know are dead and those we guess have joined the White King. That's why it's fuzzy. We don't know how many joined the pagans, so we have an upper bound of around 61, but not a lower bound. There's a bit of unknown with how many drafters in the last 10 years have been reported dead before their freeing who might actually be alive. Those records are weak and don't show place of birth. Then Satrap Willowbough came through here 3 months ago and offered protection and great pay to any drafters who joined him immediately. So I'm also assuming that any refugee drafter would have joined up with him at that point.
What with an army on the way to besiege Dunvio? But that's why the numbers are guess.
Irritating.
He flicked a booger into the fire.
What?
They still hadn't gotten used to how Farcudi did that every once in a while. And usually they couldn't harness those little moments of genius for things that mattered more than food and boogers. So, no escape routes from the inside out, Kip said. Outside in seems even more improbable. It will cost too many drafters to make it as quickly as you would want, especially to seize this city. Am I right?
It holds great symbolic and religious value to pagans, Tysis said. But still, no, I don't think the White King would think dedicating so many sappers to this was worth it. One of his lords of the air might feel differently.
The White King had split his armies, giving control of them to various commanders he called Lords of the Air. The Mighty thought the one known as Amrit Kamal was in charge of these besiegers, but their intelligence on that wasn't good. The Lords of the Air would do anything for a victory. They were replaced immediately if they failed.
Is there any way that any of you can see that we might buy victory without tomorrow's battle? Kip asked.
They all scowled at the map for a while.
Then Ben-Hadad said, If we simply go around the city and attack the besiegers' own supply lines, we might starve out their siege without a fight.
Besiege the besiegers? Con-Arthur said. But if it takes more than a couple weeks, the White King can bring down part of his forces and besiege us in turn, in which case we lose every advantage we've built up to this point.
That would weaken the White King's siege at Greenhaven, Tysis pointed out. If Satrap Willowbough used the opportunity to attack,
if, Winston said.
He was right. Audacity wasn't the satrap's strong suit.
Kip couldn't trust him to see and take advantage of what might be only a small opportunity, nor did he want to put his raiders through setting and undergoing a siege at the same time. It was totally the opposite of what they'd done before.
If we attack the Blood Robes briefly and let their messengers through, they might be recalled. Again, without a fight, Big Leo said.
I like this thinking, Kip said. There's a problem with that, Tysis said. If you free the city in a clever way where the Blood Robes simply leave, that's wonderful and we'll have done a good thing, but we'll get no credit for it. It will just seem like Dunvio's good fortune. We'll get no new recruits, no funding and no food except what we take at the point of the spear. You take food then, and they'll hate us instead.
She was right. Damn it. They all chewed on the injustice of that, but no one disputed it was what would probably happen. Not even Antonius.
Curious world, isn't it? Kip said. Seeing your foes driven away inspires more gratitude than cunningly having others draw those same men away. The charging in is all Gavin Guile. The cunning is Andros Guile. One of them is loved and the other hated. Is that because men are so short-sighted, or because we long to see those who hurt us be hurt themselves?
Some more one, some more the other, I'd hazard, Farcudi said. He had trouble identifying rhetorical questions.
Also, Andros Guile is an asshole, Big Leo said.
There is that. Kip grinned grimly. So I have to let more men die so that their friends will be grateful enough to replenish my ranks of the dead and continue to support us and keep the rest of us alive. In other words, I have to be cunning enough to not be cunning.
The most important part of seeking victory is defining it first, Tysis said.
Shit, Kip said, and I had this really brilliant idea about how to get around the Blood Robes' partial river blockade, too.
I'm sure you did, dear, Tysis said.
You know how they've set up the weirs to block the city from getting any fish, Kip said.
Are we going to use this idea? Tysis asked gently.
No, he grumbled.
She said. We wait at your command, my lord, despite the hour.
I mean, it was an ingenious idea, Kip said. You'd all be very impressed.
Cruxo theatrically stifled a yawn. As if at a signal, everyone else stretched and rubbed their eyes. Even Con Arthur blinked sleepily.
I hate you guys, Kip said.
He waved his hand and the battle order appeared on the map. Study your positions, then go. Sleep fast. Con Arthur, a word. It was almost scary how well they worked together now. His commanders knew exactly what they needed to do and how and when. In turn, he gave them a huge amount of autonomy. He'd even taken to rotating commanders over various elements, partly so that each understood the other's duties and problems and speed, and partly so that the army wouldn't splinter into factions. The common soldiers certainly had favourite commanders, but they trusted all of them. They all soon left, except for Con Arthur and Tysis, who withdrew subtly.
Con Arthur,
We need to have that talk.
Which talk, my lord?
The one neither of us wants to have. The muscles in Conarthur's jaw clenched. Kip had had the other sections of the map brought in and assembled. He'd had to learn to get over his reflexive avoidance of inconveniencing his servants and subordinates. If someone needed to be wakened so Kip could think, even if it was only once in 100 times that he came up with a stratagem or noticed an error in his plans, that one time in 100 was worth waking them. Tisis had directed the placement and organization of the figures on the map. Each refugee reported to her, and she placed forces on the map in various colors for each report. Each was dated, too. The Willcasters had put it all into the map so Kip could watch colors blossom across the map a day at a time. His own scouts' reports bloomed in different colors. There were hundreds of false reports, exaggerations and mistakes, but with thousands of reports, those tended to reveal themselves as the noise they were. On the other hand, even low-quality reports, if repeated often enough, gave Kip a place to send his own scouts or raiding parties. If he did nothing else, this map would likely be Kip's legacy, his big advance that he'd given the world. Of course, the map had to be imbued with a bit of will, so it was technically forbidden magic. So maybe even this would disappear. He put his hands on it and extended his will. Little lights bloomed around his own forces, leagues away most of the time, but shadowing them at all times.
"These are reports of a giant grizzly," Kip said.
"Hmm. I try to keep Talak away from people, but grizzlies roam. It's their nature."
"And doubtless," Kip said agreeably, "some farmers and shepherds who know that we travel with Talak have caught a glimpse of something in the woods and reported it as him, hoping for us to reimburse them for lost livestock."
"Right, right,"
Conarthur said. He thought Kip was going to let it go, and how Kip wanted to. Kip slowed down the advancement of the map. Lights bloomed simultaneously tens of leagues apart, one day, then another, and another. "Odd, isn't it?" Kip asked. "A series of these reports come from the kind of places I would expect you to send Talak, abandoned areas with good hunting mostly and few humans. Others, sometimes simultaneous with those, come from more populated areas." Conarthur swallowed but said nothing. "What happens then if we assign a different colour to the ones in rational areas than to the ones way too close to settlements?" He started the series over again, and suddenly the reports made sense. Still shadowing the Nightbringers, two dots hunted the forests nearby, the red always farther from villages, the blue always closer. There were still a few false positives from bad reports, but otherwise it explained all the data.
"This is all guesswork,"
Conarthur said, but he sounded more sick than defiant.
"Somebody's going to get killed," Kip said gently.
"I can handle it."
"So you don't know," Kip said.
"Know what?"
The quick crease of his forehead told Kip he was telling the truth.
"Someone's been killed already."
All the colour drained out of the big redhead.
"No, or Hullum forbid it. I would know if..."
"Not by Lorcan. By Talak."
"What? Lorcan? I told you my brother's bear is dead. What?"
"Two hunters heard a giant grizzly was eating folks' pigs. They got liquored up and decided to go hunting. Said they'd be damned if some dark Tyrian, that's me, I assume, would tell them what to do in their own woods. One survived."
"Well, maybe that's their own fault then, right? We've warned the people everywhere to stay clear."
"Talak shouldn't have been in that area at all, Ruachan. And you know it. Wouldn't have been there except that you had to keep him on this side of the river so Lorcan wouldn't attack him. Am I right?"
Kip could see Conarthur trying to build up a rage, but the big man couldn't do it.
"How long have you known?"
he asked instead.
"He's your brother. You love him," Kip said.
"So?"
"All along. As you've known what needs to happen, but knowing in your heart takes time."
Kip put his hand on the big man's shoulder.
"It's been almost a year."
"You were giving me time to do the right thing,"
Conarthur said.
"Mm-hmm.
And I never did it."
"How much of Ronan is left inside that bear?"
"Good days and bad. It's as bad as when our mother lost the light of reason. Never thought I'd have to go through that hell twice,"
Kip said,
when you have to go through hell, go quickly. Tears dripped silently down the big man's face.
I thought if anyone might be the exception, it would be him. I thought maybe he could beat this.
He's made it this long. That is exceptional, Kip said. But we both know, when he goes, he could take out an entire village easy as snapping your fingers. There's no cure. If it were you...
I know. You think I haven't told myself all that 1,000 times? I just can't do it.
And he wouldn't want anyone else to do it either. He'd never forgive himself for that. Or whoever did it. Kip said nothing for a while. Then he said, The battle tomorrow's going to be tougher than most of us realize. We think of Dunvio as a backwater. The White King is a pagan. He thinks of it as the capital of Blood Forest. He's not going to retreat. Conarth's brow wrinkled. Kip said, When you, as Talak, of course, and I ride out here into full view, I'll throw up some firebirds and put some signal flares on this ridge just before dawn. When their people see a giant grizzly outfitted for war, it'll be hard to look anywhere else. If Lorcan can swim the river and land here and come fast through this gully, he'll be in the underbelly of the camp in minutes. If he can hit the camp, if he can give just a few minutes of chaos right when the sun dawns, it'd make all the difference. No one wants to face one giant grizzly. Trapped between two?
Hell, I wouldn't want to do that,
Conarth grunted. You think he can do that? Conarth examined the terrain.
That's a suicide run.
That's right, Kip said. He let that sit, didn't defend it.
But one that will save many lives if it works,
Conarth said. If, Kip said, it's a gamble. He may die for nothing. He wasn't going to twist the Con's arm into this. Conarth was quiet again. Then he said,
Surely a man who gives his life trying to save his friends is just as much a hero as one who dies actually saving them, right?
Better to die trying to do good than make your own brother blow your head off, Kip said. Conarth took a deep breath, then nodded.
Ronan would have agreed with that.
Then go and speak with him. If all goes well tomorrow night, we celebrate. And the next day, we mourn.
As it should be,
Conarth said. He'd regained some composure, but he was still taking deep, gulping breaths. He left swiftly. Kip sat down and silently studied the map. Tysis came up beside him, and he rested his hand companionably on her hip.
You did good there, she said.
Did I? He asked.
How could you even ask that? She said. You gave him every chance to come clean on his own, and then when he didn't, you gave him the chance to give his brother a hero's death.
But why? Kip said.
What do you mean? Did I hold back until now because I didn't want to force him to kill his brother? And lo and behold, here came an opportunity to avoid all that? Or did I, like my grandfather, keep Ronan off the table like a card to play at an opportune moment? Am I a good man, or just a fatter iteration of Andros Guile?
She let part of that pass, though he saw the tightness in her jaw.
So you did something devious and brilliant, and also callous. But it was also kind and respectful and life-giving. What if, my lord husband, you are a man with not one nature, but two?
Two?
What if you were not only flesh, but also spirit, and those moments when you bring the two together are not failures, but are your moments of deepest integrity and brilliance?
You think I'm brilliant? Kip asked.
I can't believe you still question it, she said. But the real question is, do you think you're good?
No, Kip said without hesitation. Competent, crazy, stubborn, cunning sometimes. She sighed and looked at the map.
What are you looking for?
Clarity, he said. He thought about getting out the rope spear and working on it quietly for a few minutes or an hour to ease his mind. Young Garrett had died in a raid and shattered his heirloom sea demon bone spear. Kip thought he'd figured out a way to make those bone fragments into the spine for the rope spear, which would give it some unique abilities. But Tysis always got that aggrieved look on her face when he worked on the thing, like he wasn't paying attention to her or something. He didn't know what her problem was, but she seemed to hate the thing. Anyway, it could stay in its bag for now. Enough time to take it out after Tysis went to bed.
She said nothing for a few minutes, then kissed his cheek.
You'll not find clarity tonight, I think. Come to bed, or you'll stay up so late that it costs you the clarity you'll need tomorrow.
He followed her to the other side of the command tent. Their personal quarters consisted of a small area separated by a curtain, a chest to sit on, and a pile of blankets on the ground. There was barely room for the room's slave Verity, a gift from Irene that they had not been able to refuse, to stand with them, helping Tisis undress.
I'll not be able to sleep, Kip said.
Truth was, he wouldn't mind some distraction before he went back to the maps. They hadn't made love all day.
You don't need sleep tonight, she said.
Well, that was promising, especially as Verity peeled away her dress. But Tisis dismissed the slave and continued.
What you need is introspection and time. Come and rest on my breast.
Rest after? He asked.
No.
Rest first? He asked.
Only. Rest only.
You wouldn't lose yourself to pleasure tonight, or if you did, you'd feel guilty about doing so while Con Arthur is out having one of the worst nights of his life.
Be nice to forget all that for a little while. Tonight you need to think about brothers, and family, and what they mean. And that means thinking about what you didn't have, and don't have, and what you were cheated of, and what you're thankful for. I don't want to help you avoid that hurt, Kip. I want to help you heal it.
Kip lay his head in her lap as she stroked his hair, and then later upon her breast.
He didn't think. Though she'd expected him to think of family and of love for the longest time, here in her softness and her strength, here with his family and this love, he didn't think at all.